Journal Committee Report 11 has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Nutting, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, may I have the privilege of the floor?
You may.
Mr. President, I'd like to introduce to the Senate two individuals that are over here. Martha King, who is Director for Health Programs at the National Conference of State Legislatures, and Laura Tobler, who's a Program Director, the healthcare programs there. They're here to conduct a training for us on what's actually in the National Health Reform Act. They had a session this morning. There will be another session on the adjournment of both houses this afternoon, and I would encourage everybody to attend. It's a good chance to learn some of the basics and to get your questions answered. It was a very productive session this morning, and I urge those that didn't manage to make that or couldn't make all of it that it's worthwhile to attend. So I ask the Senate to help me welcome Ms. King, Ms. Tobler.
Welcome, and thank you for what you're about to do in regard to our understanding of a very complex issue. Introduction, reading, and reference of bills. Senate File 94, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 94, Liability for Emergency Equipment Donations, an Act Relating to Immunity, sponsored by Senator Johnson.
Senate File 94 has been referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 57, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 57, 100th State Fair Celebration, and Act Relating to the State Fair, sponsored by Senator Anderson.
Senate File 57 has been referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senate File 47, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 47, Concealed Weapons, and Act Relating to Concealed Weapons, sponsored by Senator Jennings.
Senate File 47 has been assigned to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 97, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 97, Concealed Weapons, Retired Law Enforcement, and Act Relating to Firearms, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss.
Senate File 97 has been assigned to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 100, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 100, Cruelty to Animals, an Act Relating to Cruelty to Animals, sponsored by Senator Geis.
Senate File 100 has been assigned to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Senate File 56, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 56, Real Estate Brokers and Salesmen's Revisions, an Act Relating to Real Estate Brokers and Salesmen, sponsored by Senator Johnson.
Senate File 56 has been assigned to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Senate File 59, first reading of the bill.
Senate File Number 59, Spice Drugs, an Act Relating to the Wyoming Controlled Substances Act, sponsored by Senator Escobel.
Senate File 59 has been assigned to Committee Number 10, Labor. Senate File 95, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 95, Legislative Committee Membership, and Act Relating to the Legislature, sponsored by Senator Meyer.
Senate File 95 has been assigned to Committee Number 12, Rules. Reports from standing committees.
January the 12th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 18, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Cooper, Johnson, Landon, Nutting, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 13th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 32, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman. January the 13th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 33, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Driscoll, Escobel, no, Senator Dockstader, Senator Burns, Chairman. January the 13th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 28, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Burns.
Mr. President, Senate File 33, State Parks Acquisition of Land, sponsored by the TRW Committee, has an appropriation. I would ask that you re-refer it to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
Seeing no objections, that would be so ordered.
He was a no vote on it.
Perkins.
Mr. President, Senate File 69 has been referred to the Judiciary Committee, and we would ask that it be re-referred to Committee Number 12, Rules Committee.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Seeing no objections, so ordered. Members of the Senate, before we move into the Committee of the Whole this morning, we do have, a special ceremony coming up. I'm going to just take a moment of ease. I can confer with the clerk and see whether or not we want to move directly into the Committee of the Whole, or if, in fact, we might pause until our ceremony presenter is here. So with that, we'll just stand at ease. members of the Senate, I would like to take a moment this morning to honor our military professionals in Wyoming. We have several members of the Readiness Support Team here with us, as well as a number of veterans and service members in the gallery above. Today, we're also honoring the countless numbers of Wyoming National Guard members serving both home and abroad. Please help me welcome the Adjutant General of Wyoming Military Department, Major General Ed Wright, to the chamber and help honor our military members.
Is this on?
General Wright, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. President. Distinguished Senators, thank you for the support that you and your constituents give to our members of the military and veterans every day. We don't take that for granted. This state of Wyoming is probably one of the top in the nation for what you do for members, active members of the military and veterans. Today I want to share with you for a moment a little about what the Wyoming Military Department as an organization is doing to assist you in supporting our troops. We do not believe that the health and well-being of our soldiers, airmen, families, and communities should fall on someone else's shoulders. We carry those burdens proudly, knowing the more we can do to support our people, the healthier and safer and more prepared they will be to support our state and nation. Our readiness support team members, some of whom are here today, work diligently in a number of programs dedicated to one mission, supporting our soldiers and airmen and their families. We partner with the Department of Health to ensure Wyoming veterans, advocates like Rhonda Brauberger-Lee, assist veterans and their families to obtain needed mental health services and other benefits. Knowing the current conflicts have more traumatic brain injuries than any other conflict in our nation's history, we have put a heavy emphasis on mental health, including spiritual health, within our organization. Our chaplainry has grown considerably over the last 10 years as we have recognized the absolute need of faith-based support for our soldiers, airmen, and their families. Chaplain David Hall is our full-time headquarters chaplain. He returned from deployment in April, where he ministered to our brigade soldiers' faith-based needs. Our Director of Psychological Health, Tris Banyan, who is not able to be with us today, provides clinical assessments for a variety of behavioral health issues to our Wyoming Military Department personnel and families by promoting mental fitness and personal wellness in a confidential manner, ensuring they receive the best treatment available to them. We know our soldiers and airmen are not our sole responsibilities. Their families weigh on us as well. Bill Breckenridge, our Director of Joint Family Programs, and program managers in the Army and Air ensure a trained volunteer network is in place to provide comprehensive support and benefits to military families across the state and country. Among those benefits is the Wyoming Military Trust Fund. That fund, established by this body in 2004, has provided more than $2.5 million to 753 Wyoming families in the last year. Supporting our family members and communities by ensuring they have the information, resources, and services available to be better equipped for deployments and reintegration is the mission of our Army and Air Yellow Ribbon programs. Captain Jeremy Sparks and Mrs. Roxy Arnold create events to ensure service and benefit providers, community members, and our families and military members work together for success. Retired Brigadier General Stephen Pappas and his statewide network of employer support of the Guard and Reserve volunteers work to ensure our civilian employers understand, support, and value our military missions and that both the employer and employees understand applicable laws and their rights under them. These programs, along with a variety of others, are in place to assist all of you in supporting Wyoming military members, veterans, and their families and employers. Today, the gallery is filled with representatives from the National Guard, support staff, and Wyoming veterans. We all thank you for your continued support. Thank you.
Thank you, Major General Wright. We will help spread the word of your readiness support team to ensure our military members and families take advantage of the services that you provide. I also want to thank you and the current and former members of the military in the gallery today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you for your service. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are now at the order of business for the consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senator Cole, would you please approach the desk?
The committee of the whole, please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 11. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
Senate File 11, CHINS, Administrative Change of Placement, an act relating to children in need of supervision, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. It was referred to committee number one. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins, Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee whole rise and report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 11, CHINS, Administrative Change of Placement. Mr. Chairman, with your leave, I'll go ahead and explain the bill. There are no amendments. Mr. Chairman, what we've got before us is a committee bill regarding placement of children. If I can have your indulgence, I'll give a little bit of history of background, which will help us understand what we're doing in this particular bill. Mr. Chairman, we have a number of years ago established a legislative policy that we've been moving in the direction with respect to the placement of children who are in need of supervision. That initial policy set by this body has been that children should be placed in put in placements that are as least restrictive as possible. The other policy consideration involved in this particular bill is that we make, when we make an appropriate change in placement of a juvenile, that placement, particularly downward placements into less restrictive placements, would be done as quickly as possible. That accomplishes two goals. One is that it's for the best benefit of that child to be in the least restrictive placement as possible, which is a step or path, hopefully, towards reuniting that juvenile with their family. The other one is it saves the state substantial amounts of money. A few years ago, I remember while taking testimony on the Joint Judiciary Committee, I was absolutely astounded at the amount of money that we use when in taking care of what it costs us to have juveniles in out-of-home placements. The number I remember, and I don't hold me to this, but for some reason it sticks in my mind, was the neighborhood of over $30,000. That's come down significantly as we've pursued a process of trying to, one, put them in the least restrictive placement as possible, and two, move them down into less and less restrictive placements and towards reunification with family as soon as possible. What we have in Senate File 11, then, that accomplishes a couple of things. The first thing that it does is, if you go to 14.6.429, so we're starting at the bottom of 1 and to the top of page 2, we're striking the language in here that talks about having to go back to the court to seek permission to put the child in a less restrictive placement. In this situation, you will already have the juvenile committed to the care of the Department of Family Services, and so they're already charged with custody of the child. So what we're talking about is the ability to remove the child from a more restrictive placement. Particularly, what we're talking about when you have the most restrictive placement is a psychiatric placement of a child where you have the most expensive and certainly the most restrictive. And so the object is that when it becomes appropriate, the department can move that child or that juvenile to a less restrictive placement without a further court order. The reason you don't want to have to do a court order is most of the time no one's going to object to move that child to a less restrictive placement. It'll also, again, less restrictive placements are the policy that we're seeking in this body, and also will save substantial amounts of money. In doing so, what is still left in the statute is that there still is a 10-day notice. Before that change is made, there's a 10-day notice that goes out to parents, it goes out to the court, it goes out to the people who are involved in the initial placement in the first place. So there's a 10-day notice. If they object to that, to the less restrictive placement happening, then they provide that notice and there'll be a hearing on that. If no one objects, then the DFS can go ahead and move the child to a less restrictive placement. The other thing that this bill does is the repealer, which is a significant portion of the bill. The repealer strikes out subsection N of the same section. In that section, if you go and read it, what they're doing there is just talking about going back to the court and court approval, so it's inconsistent with what we're doing. It also takes care of the repealer on section, and also takes care of the fact that most of these placements are Medicaid eligible expenditures, and so we have the federal government paying half of the cost of these Medicaid placements. Under its current regulations, CMS, if I have the which I don't even know what CMS stands for, but I think it's CMS. What is it? Center for Medicaid Services. Thank you. Is in charge of monitor is the fiscal arm of paying for those things. And what they have in the regulations now is if you actually have a placement ordered in a court, by a court order, they will not pay their half of the Medicaid placement costs. The idea behind that is that judges are not psychiatrists or not psychologists and don't have the professional capability to actually be making those placement orders. So what we're doing in N is both, in repealing N, is we're removing the requirement of court order to change the to a lesser restrictive, and also it puts us in compliance where we'll still be eligible to receive the benefit of the Medicaid dollars from CMS with respect to Medicaid placement costs. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for your favorable recommendation. Would stand for questions.
Questions on Senate File 11? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, two questions, if I may. First, the simple one, as I read subsection M and the little I and two little I, who the notice goes to, it says served on the child, child's parents, child's representatives, current place provider, and the district attorney. Is the child's representative, is that a guardian ad litem? Is that who is getting the notice there? The second question, I've been studying this bill and trying to track it, and I'm having difficulty understanding that it's restricted to just placing in a less restrictive environment. Suppose the state agency goes the other way. Does this remove the court restrictions on that, too, so the state agency could place in a more restrictive environment?
Further discussion, Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, the answer to the first question is that's correct. The child's representative, if there's one appointed, would it be a GAL. It could be a guardian ad litem. Could be any other individual who's been in whatever capacity has been appointed to represent that child's interest in the proceedings. So the object there is then to everybody involved has notice of the intent to less restrictive. And you know, there may be instances where parents or the guardian ad litem would say, you have got to be out of your mind. You cannot put this child in a less restrictive environment for their own good. So that's the answer to the first question. Second question is, this is limited to, in subsection M, is limited specifically to this. You can make a lateral change or a less restrictive change. You can't make a more restrictive change without going back to the court and having the court's approval, and there will be a hearing on a more restrictive placement.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good senator from Petrona County did answer one of my questions about the notification that the residential treatment facility is going to get notified, so that I think is appropriate. But the question I would have is that if you have a residential facility that's a psychiatric facility, and could it be that they would have custody of the child or actually control of the child and not agree with the department or the psychiatric treatment provider at the facility would make a recommendation that it stay in a residential facility. What does the department do? Do they have, their own psychiatric evaluation capabilities, or do they contract out for that? I'm assuming there has to be that evaluation by some psychiatrist that says that it's warranted to put them in a less restrictive facility. And so I'm just a little curious about what duties the department has or what they actually do to make that determination.
Senator Perkins?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding, if I remember from the testimony correctly, there's only two residential facilities that are at the highest level of care of psychiatric placement for juveniles. And one of them, I think, is in Albany County, and another one is in Natrona County. There's only two that are actually there. But anyway, there's not very many, and there's also a very, very limited number. What's that? Torrington, thank you. That's right. We had our meeting right by there the other day. That's right, this summer. Now I've lost my train of thought. Anyway,
what was your question?
No, but we digress. With respect to the placement providers provided that notice of the least restrictive placement, and if the placement providers provided that notice, it, along with anybody else who receives notice, has the ability to object to that, and if there's an objection, then it would be set for a hearing that would occur before that. My understanding is there's only a couple of also child adolescent psychiatrists in the state, and the Department of Family Services does have a contract with a child psychiatrist at its that comes in on a contract basis to come in and help with the evaluations where they're needed. So ultimately, long story short, or maybe a short story longer, is that we would, if there's a hearing, then there's opportunity for other types of evaluations on the child, and there would be a hearing, and that information would be presented to the court, and the court would determine and resolve the objection to the lower placement. Does that answer your question?
Further discussion, Senator Meyer?
Yeah, just to clarify the question is that I really want to know whether or not the department what they do to make that determination that it needs a lesser that the needs of the child are better served in a lesser restrictive setting. They're in a psychiatric controlled setting at the current time as I understand. And the department says, well, we can move this child into a lesser restrictive, less expensive setting. And I need to know are they doing it solely to save dollars, or are they doing it in the best interest of the child? And I understand the different areas where you can have objections and you can have a hearing, but I would like to know that there's some due diligence in the original decision to move that child to a less restrictive setting, and I'd like to know what that due diligence is.
Further discussion, Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In trying to answer that, let me just go back and categorize this for the Senate. There are three kind of categories for juvenile placement. The lowest category, of course, is CHINS. That stands for Child in Need of Supervision. The worst juvenile placements is, of course, for delinquency. And those are for kids that actually have committed crimes and so forth. And then you have abuse and neglect cases. We're talking about children that need some supervision. It may not always be a psychiatric facility. And one of the problems that we also faced when the good chairman spoke about that cost of court-ordered placements, we were making a lot of placements out of state. And so when the chairman talked about 30,000, it was actually like more like 30 million. You said 30,000, but it was, it's, yeah, and so what we're trying to do is, one, to bring the kids back in to the state, make that lateral move if we can. In addition, those kids that are in, say, for instance, the facility in Torrington or the facility in Laramie, there comes a point in time where they have been involved. There's a caseworker from DFS involved. There are not only professionals involved, but there comes a time where we need to, where that child is, for lack of a better term, has reached improvement. And now we want to reunify that family. We want to bring them closer to home, if at all possible, which dovetails into our whole regional plan for juvenile placement and juvenile care and mental health care throughout the state. And so in so doing, it may be that with the combination of, first of all, you got to remember in those hearings or in that case, the court doesn't lose control of that case. The court has MDTs and has every 6 month reviews of these matters. But the question comes down to how much interference do we want to get involved in terms of making that decision to make a lateral or less restrictive move. And in this situation, there are two reasons to do that. One, there are ample protections for the child and for the providers and everybody else in the system. And two, quite frankly, CMS is required that for those kinds of moves, it does not require an order of the court, but requires that what we do is make the provider or DFS, the child is placed into the custody of DFS, and that is the person under CMS rules, or the entity under CMS rules, that must make that decision to make that lateral or least restrictive change.
Further discussion, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask, was there any testimony that would quantify the effect on the federal cost share and what it does to our general fund with this particular change? It sounds like it's beneficial, but I don't know whether we're talking about $1,000 or 30 million. If you have some figures on that, I'd be quite interested. Second, what's the exact nature of the CMS rule? Did I hear right when y'all said that if it's a court-ordered thing, the feds won't pay? Does that apply to the initial placement? Do we need to look at restructuring the way we do these? Because we're talking big money here in these court-ordered placements. And if there's some opportunities here to get creative, we're dealing with a big shortfall in Medicaid, and we need to be conscious of it.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, the problem with these court orders initially has been that the court would order that the child be placed at a certain entity. And that was problematic. CMS would not pay for that. But if the court orders say that the child is placed into the custody of DFS, then they can make the decision in terms of placement. Now, the court can say placed into the custody of DFS for somewhere. But you have to have this magic language, apparently. And so that's the nature of I hope I've answered your question. I don't know in terms of dollars. I will tell you that that DFS is and through our juvenile justice yearly review, we have made substantial decreases in our cost of court-ordered placements. And we are looking, that is a last resort, folks. We are really trying to, when we started with single point of entry and all of those other bills, community juvenile service boards, to try to keep the child at home, keep the child in his community, and provide those services within the community. But when we get into where the child does need to be placed, then that's how the order has to be framed now.
Senator Scott?
Chairman. The more I hear about this, Mr. Chairman, the better I like this little bill. It does seem like it's going to take care of the problem with CMS with regard to the lateral moves and the moves that are going to a least restrictive environment. Is there still a problem with the initial placement, which may well be in a very restrictive environment, and then you hope for progress as time goes on, and that's where there is some big money. Is that capable of being reached in this legislation? Is there other legislation in the works, or is there an opportunity to take a hard look at this in the future with the potential for improving the system and making sure the courts use the right language in what they do so the feds will pay up?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to my fellow senator from Natrona County, that's exactly where we're headed. Those numbers that were, and I misspoke, if I said 30,000, I meant 30, the number sticks in my mind as 34 million. And that was, I think that might have been at the high point. And through the efforts of trying to have less restrictive placements closer to home, We've reduced that substantially, and I'll see if I can get a hold of the folks over there and see if I can have those numbers for you on second reading if this passes through, so I may be able to have those numbers specifically for you. The other thing I can report on also is that there was some testimony that they've actually started to meet with district judges and others to try and help them understand about the rules and how to frame these orders right to make sure that we're falling within the guidelines. So outside of the legislation, there are actions that are being taken by the Department of Family Services right now to help everybody get on the same page so that we're complying with both our statute and also the federal regulation with respect to Medicaid reimbursement. And just to follow up on the good senator from Goshen County behind me, I think in with respect to that, the due diligence they have is as the good majority floor leader said, there's a caseworker for each of these kids, and there's periodic reviews. And so you're looking at schoolwork, and keep in mind that the placements we're talking about may be psychiatric, it may be something much less, it may be just a youth crisis center, it may be just supervision at home, there could be any number of levels of that. But ultimately, there's a caseworker assigned. These cases are reviewed regularly. Progress is monitored, everything from whether they're on medications to whether they're attending school to if they're having other problems, if the restrictive environment still allows them to be out in the community and in school, whether they're attending school, how they're doing in school. All of those things are being tracked with these children. And when DFS, in its obligation and with the charge that they have, is to act in the best interest of the child, when they believe that child can be replaced in a less restrictive environment on the process or the program to get them reunited with their family, then they make those recommendations. Whether or not a caseworker at some point in time and whether or not there's some unwritten quota in order to save money, I doubt that very much. What our concern is trying to get the best care we can for the best for the least dollars that we can, but at the same time provide the needs that are out there. So anyway, that's the only thing, additional things I would add, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Esquivel?
This type of system in the past, part of the due diligence, if I'm not mistaken, there are child protection teams composed of the caseworker, school social worker, school nurse, mental health worker, county attorney, and individuals such as that normally would work on these cases and make a recommendation after a thorough assessment. At least that's the way it's supposed to work, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring this up just from some personal experience from the standpoint where you may have a facility that has a 9-month psychiatric or a 6-month psychiatric program that this child's supposed to go through, and DFS will come in and pretty much solely to save money will say, well, we just can't afford this anymore, so we're going to cut this short. Yet they expect the provider to go ahead and provide that extra 2, 3, or 4 months psychiatric at no charge. And so it's really a matter of biting into the profitability or just the basis of even breaking even for some of these providers. And so that's why I brought it up as far as the due diligence. I know they have caseworkers. I know they have all of the different protections there. And I know there's that hearing possible, but frankly, the providers are at a disadvantage in that situation, yet they're expected to go ahead and provide those services at no cost. And that's something that, as you've seen, some of these providers across the state go broke, and I think you've seen a lot of information out. I don't know if you've all had the opportunity to read it, from the standpoint that there's a lot of these providers that may not be in business in a few months or even a year. And so that's just one of the parts that's part of the puzzle about why some of these providers are facing very hard economic times. I think this is a good bill. I think it should go forward. But I think this is something that element of due diligence and how these different cases are determined and who pays for it and what, that we're leaving everything on the back of our providers, and it's something that we're going to have to address. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion, Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, and just in that, and I appreciate the good sentiments, and there are, it's just not limited to the folks in his district. There are a number of providers around the state that have struggled. My understanding is part of that was that there's been some slow pay issues with the department, which don't have anything to do with this bill. The other thing that's happened is through the policy that we've set in this body for less restrictive placements have dropped almost 50%. And so one of the issues that you have that's affecting the profitability that's out there is there just are not as many kids in these high restrictive placements anymore. And we may find that if we're successful in our war on drugs, for example, we may find that we don't need as many drug residential treatment facilities, and there's going to be providers that are going to be struggled and pinched by that. And that, unfortunately, that's one of the prices that come with success in a program. If you're having success, you don't need as many providers, and that creates the significant market issues and business issues for those individuals. That being said, however, I think even DFS would be the first to admit that they don't always get it right. And obviously that's our job, is to continue to monitor and watch those situations to try and make sure this is part about money, but it's mostly about taking care of kids and getting reunited with families and trying to ward off those problems and help make them productive members of society so that they don't end up in the wrong places in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Questions on Senator Perkins' motion that Senate File 11 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 11 pass Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration, Senate File 16. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 16. It's adequate. Days. Over. Senate File 16, School Facilities Adequacy Assessment, and Act Relating to School Facilities, sponsored by the School Facilities Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Co-Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the Committee of the Whole rises, I ask to do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 16, and I will explain it to you, Mr. Chairman. This piece of legislation comes to you after pretty much monthly meetings of the Facilities Commission Committee over the last year. There's other legislation that will come out later, but this piece right here basically goes into how we're putting together the assessment of the schools and who gets built when. And as you can remember, there's been a lot of discussion about, well, my school was on the list at this level, and then there was a reassessment, and it moved down or up, and that over the years that we've been doing this, has been quite a bit of discussion on that. Basically, what they've done now, prior to this bill, is that 50% of the building design goes into the formula, about 35% goes into capacity, and 15% into functionality. When you look at the repealer on here, we're basically taking out the we're taking out in the current statutes the criteria for building capacity, building construction, educational suitability, technology readiness established by the commission rule, and on and on. So we're taking that out, and we're basically replacing it with what you see here in this bill. And what we're doing is we're trying to take into consideration more the condition of the building and what's going on. Because once you put the capacity formula in there, you know, that capacity will fluctuate in our communities, and then that changes it. But we could have a and when we say one of the lesser buildings in Wyoming, we have to be cognizant of the idea or the reality that in Wyoming, even our worst building in Wyoming is much better than most buildings in the rest of the states around us. So when we're starting to look at one of the buildings on lesser condition, but capacity starts to change up and down, it will move that around. So what we're trying to do here is pull out the condition of the building and bring it up a little bit in the definition and the statute here, so that if we do have a building that's starting to deteriorate or needs more attention, that building will get weighted a little bit more. The things that that we really discussed was the language on page 3, starting on line 20, the criteria and measures for building condition, which incorporate educational suitability and technology readiness, specifically taking into consideration appropriate and up-to-date standards for air quality, illumination, and appropriateness of the student environment as established by commission rule. And then it goes on, which over time brings statewide buildings and facilities to targeted, adequate levels prescribed by the commission. Now that's what replaces the repealer, and that's what's trying to bring this the condition of building up. Mr. Chairman, I think that's the short version and the easy version, and I'd stand for any questions.
Discussion on Senate File 16. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions. With respect to the capacity issue, by eliminating capacity, are you now no longer able to deal with it? Does that mean you take modulars to a new community where they may need new schools? And second part of the question is that with respect to now that we're making condition of the buildings a higher priority, how do we know that and have assurances that communities are using their major maintenance to take care of their buildings and not creating a self-imposed condition issue by simply not choosing to put all their money in one facility, allowing one to go derelict?
Senator Jennings?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you, a couple of places here we need to look on your question. If you go to page 4, line 13, the commission shall only request capital outlay for a building with capacity needs identified under the previous paragraph of this section after consideration of all other remedies for that building, including reorganization of schools within the district. So we're not taking out capacity. We're just looking at it at a different level. If you go down and on page 5 where we started to talk about the different points of capacity, you see an analysis of the number of classrooms within the building, including an examination of the building square footage devoted to classrooms compared to the building. And so we're not removing it. What we're trying to do is weight. We're not removing capacity. We're trying to weight the condition of the building heavier than what we've been doing in the past. So capacity is still there. It's still a component of what the commission uses to do their formula.
Senator Nicholas?
Then I see Fremont County was about ready to jump up there. As soon as any time you see reorganization, I expect that. But the... But I guess the question is, you know, and that's an interesting thing. As we begin to use facilities commissions to decide where buildings ought to go, and you do get into the reorganization issue, and I guess, is it our intent to give the facilities commission a bigger say and role in reorganization and consolidation, or are we going to keep that totally as a legislative function?
Senator Jennings.
I don't think that we want, I think we're going to keep the consolidation ideas where it is, but I think as it's worded here and what our intent was, is that we want to look and make sure that all the buildings are being utilized in a district or in a school area prior to going in and building more. So I think our intent is to leave the decision here, but be a little bit more, a little bit more informed on what's going on there. I don't think that this really gives the commission a bunch more power that they don't already have. It just tells them to go out and look at more data.
Yeah. Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just take a minute, if I may, to comment here on some of the concepts of what we're doing. And I think the presenter has done a good job in talking about the detail. This school CapCon process has been indeed a journey, and it's been a journey that's taken a lot of time, it's taken a lot of resource. And as we move along this journey, the needs change somewhat. Early on in the process and given the direction of the courts in regard to our responsibility to provide adequacy within all of our schools, capacity was probably a bigger, larger issue at that point than it has become now. As we've worked our way through this process, we have dealt in many and most instances with those schools that had capacity issues. So the task has changed somewhat. I have within my district a school that has grown some. We have modulars, and capacity is an issue, and that's being appropriately and properly addressed. But I think the intention of the bill primarily is to adjust these formulas, which are weighted in many and most instances, in this instance, particularly in regard to capacity, that are weighted perhaps now in a manner that does not fit the current situation as appropriate as it might. So in regard to how will these issues then be addressed in the future and by whom, I think that the responsibility will remain much as it is now. However, it will be addressed more appropriately in a case-by-case manner when it comes to condition. And then we then can move on into consideration of those areas that would deal appropriately in a better manner perhaps with school climate, teaching climate, safe, friendly, healthy environment for children. So having said that, I think it's just an adjustment in the formula that's more appropriate for the time that we find ourselves in this journey in regard to school CapCon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, a question on page 4, line 17, where it places the authority for reorganization of schools within the district. With the Facilities Commission. My concern there is we have a number of districts within the state that are large, geographically dispersed districts that operate sometimes very small schools in very rural areas. And the way I read this, the School Facilities Commission can come in and say, you've got a grade school, and I'm just picking one at random. There's a grade school at Willow Creek, which is in northern Natrona County. It's actually closer to Johnson County than it is to anywhere else in Natrona County. The way I read this, the School Facilities Commission can close that school. I worry about that. It's only a K-4 school. It serves ranches around there. And when I say ranches around there, there's one family that commutes every day. They bring their two children in. It's about 44 miles on a dirt road, but that's the closest school for little kids. I have no objection as they get older. We'll bus them to KC or Midwestern or Trona. But what this gives is the authority to close that little school for younger kids. I can name you numerous other schools. I'm not picking on Willow Creek. It's a wonderful school and a wonderful community. But I worry that a bureaucracy here in Cheyenne will go up without knowing, no ill intent, and close that little school to the detriment of particularly those K-4 kids. Is what I'm reading here, should I be alarmed, or are you going to ease my concerns?
Senator Vebow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too, share those same concerns on page 4, line 17, and I won't reiterate what my colleague from Johnson County has already said. Another set of questions I have on page 3, lines 20 through 24, and on over to page 4. I'm trying to get a handle on how you're going to bring in with these new criteria. You know, we talk about building condition. We're eliminating building capacity, but now we're going to take on consideration of air quality, illumination, and appropriateness. How are you going to quantify that when you look at schools that may, in fact, have been, they're in good condition, but they may not qualify this? And further, as you look around the state, how are you going to do a statewide assessment relative to those new requirements?
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who said this was going to be easy? Again, we're not taking out the capacity. We're trying to weight it different. Because in many of our areas that grew fast over in the gas, you know, the big gas, deep gas areas, those schools boomed up. Over in Campbell County, they grew up. And they're starting the capacity isn't as big an issue as the condition of the building is. So we're not eliminating capacity. But going back to can we shut that school down? I think if you go back and read the new language in there, the commission shall only request capital outlay for a building with capacity needs. So this is a capital outlay for a building that's the capacity need means it's grown and you've got portables out there and everything like that. So the commission shall only request capital outlay for a building with capacity needs that's identified under the other paragraph after consideration of all other remedies for that building, including reorganization of the schools within the district. So if you've got a school that's not growing or shrinking and it's sitting there, it's really not going to, it's not going to be looked at because it doesn't have a capacity need. Shrinking probably even less than growth. So where this kicks in is when you've got a school that's for some reason or other, that community is starting to grow. They have more children, and they're pulling the portables in. That's when you start looking. And if you have another, you know, the school, the country school way out there in the middle, really won't be affected much by this because there's no other buildings out there in that school to look at. Where this clause will come into effect and really make a difference is more like in schools in my town, where we have a school here that's starting to become over capacity. Do we build onto that? Do we go look at now and say build onto that because that school needs more capacity? No, what we're saying is go look around town and see if there's other ways that you can fix this problem prior to going out and spending money. So I hope that answers the question, that it's the smaller schools probably won't see anything from this unless they get a real boom in population.
Senator Dockstader.
Chairman, just so I understand this, under this new formula, we're bumping capacity down, taking the overall condition of the building and making that a priority. Under this formula, then, do we spend more or less on the construction of our schools in the state?
Senator Jennings?
I don't know. Mr. Chairman, my best guess would be that we would spend less. But that's just, you know, as we develop this and looking at it. If we have a school that starts to grow, and again, we're not making one a priority, we're just adjusting the weight on this. So, you know, let's look how we, but if you got a school that's starting to grow and you have other facilities over here that you could re-examine and pull into that school, it's within the school district, then we probably will spend less money because we're utilizing other facilities. Now, if those facilities are already maxed out or there are no facilities, then the request for capital outlay, then that's where we're going to have to go. So I don't think I think probably in the long run, we'll spend a little bit less.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd, you know, with respect to the amount of money we're spending on school capital construction, generally, as you recall or may not recall, when we began the process of shifting the load of financing school construction to the state, we took away the local requirement to have bond issues, and we also took the local mill levies away and shifted to the state. At that time, we were principally building schools with co-lease bonuses. Co-lease bonuses have declined. The co-lease bonuses go into the school capital construction account. They have declined, and they may be on the continual decline. When we get to the goldenrod, we'll explain to you that's what's happening is there are revenues earmarked from federal mill royalties that go into the school foundation program account. So when you see surpluses in that account, it's not because we got a whole bunch of revenue off of state lands. It's because federal mineral royalties have increased. What we're doing now is we're siphoning off excess funds in the school foundation program account into the school capital construction account for school construction. So as we presently sit, much of, or if not all of our construction is based upon excess federal mineral royalties. These, by the way, are the same dollars that we funded the Hathaway program with. So those excess dollars, that cushion, if you will, are now going into the school capital construction account. So the amount of construction that we've done is really a legislative process. We've had testimony in the past that we have a construction capacity of about $200 million per year, $400 million per biennium. There was times where we got close to that capacity, but we're not doing that any longer because we simply don't have the revenues. To sustain and maintain our buildings in current condition, we've had people say you've got to spend $100 million, $200 million a year or whatever in those ranges, and we will maintain the condition. And by putting constant dollars into it, you're both maintaining buildings, you're rotating them, and so you don't build a backlog. And this, when you get to the budget, I think this year there's a proposal of an additional $61 million. So in direct answer to the other question, what we're spending on facilities has more to do right now with how much excess revenues we have. And there are communities out there waiting for schools. Under the present method, where you have capacity being a high driver, you could be sitting, I'll just use as an example, Laramie. You could be sitting there and having a high school that needs replacement. But because 20 or 30% of the index is capacity, if your capacity is static, you'll never get over the ridge, if you will, to get a new school. And if you go back and look at it, it's not a coincidence that most of your capital construction has come in Campbell County, Laramie County, Natrona County, because those communities that had growing student populations were getting more and more schools, and folks that had dilapidated schools but static population weren't getting schools. So you could have a school that needs replacement. They'll never get to the top of the list because of the 20% factor being allocated to capacity. Meanwhile, you might have a great school up in another county, and all they had to do is bring in a modular unit and solve their problem. So this is intended to address those issues. And with respect to the total dollars spent, this bill will have no impact with respect to whether we spend more dollars on capital construction or less. That is another policy decision that right now is being driven by the fact that we do have excess revenues. We are able to meet these obligations, and the question is how fast can we get the money whether it's prudent and how fast we can get it out to make sure that the dollars are wisely spent.
Further discussion? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and actually I appreciate that because I that's what I understood in the bottom of page 3 is that when we removed and bumped building capacity out of line 20, that then takes it out of the priority consideration. And so it's going to have much less weight in the overall determination of which schools get built in which schools get built because and with respect to where they come on the priority list. But the other question I had, which is kind of a follow up to my good friend to the from Star Valley, is not so much on the total amount that's spent, but is this going to increase or decrease the cost per square foot of the schools that were built? And in particular, you know, when I look down here and I look at this, and I understand a lot of this will come through rule and regulation, and I would hope that we keep a close eye on it. But when you look at the bottom of page 3, what we did is their criteria and measures for building condition, which incorporate education suitability and technology readiness, and then we're adding the laundry list. We're specifically taking into consideration appropriate and up-to-date standards for air quality, illumination, appropriateness of student environment as established by the commission's rule and regulation, which over time brings statewide buildings and facilities to target adequate levels prescribed by the commission. The first thing that struck me when I read that is it seems to me that might be circular, that ultimately if we expand what we're looking at in the criteria and measures for when we need a new building, then obviously there's going to be more and more schools that don't meet that level. They're going to be inadequate because we continue to raise the standard. So I think that's a concern that we're looking for, and somehow I think we need to protect ourselves over creating a circular spiral upwards that requires us to spend more and more. And for example, going back to the good senator from Fremont, when we look at that and when the School Facilities Commission establishes hopefully objective standards by which they do this, because I remember a state on the left coast from here talking about, and I don't remember how much money they put into it, but it was millions and millions of dollars, because they determined that with respect to illumination and student environment, that they would learn better under electrons generated from green energy. And so they actually spent the money to make sure that these schools were powered with wind, so that when those electric lights went on, the wind or solar or hydroelectric, whatever it was, those are green electrons. And they were surprised when somehow the test scores didn't reflect that there was a significant benefit to education from having lighting funded by green electrons. But anyway, I would hope as this goes forward that the management council and the folks that overlook this, I think in the words of the late President Reagan, trust but verify as we move forward on this.
Further discussion. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we're having a lengthy debate on this particular bill, and I think it's appropriate because we're spending big money in this school capital construction. And as I understand the comments that have been made, we're starting to draw out of our operating funds in the school foundation account for school capital construction. I suspect our current financial circumstances, that's not going to do the instruction that goes on in the schools any harm. But I think all along in the way we're going about school capital construction, we're running major risks of building palaces and destroying the value of what goes on in them because we've got our priorities wrong. So I continue to be nervous about the whole process on that score. With this, we're emphasizing condition of the buildings more. It seems to me that when you talk about the things that can go wrong in a building that runs condition down, you've got a spectrum of things that can go wrong. To use an example, Mr. Chairman, if the roof is leaking, you've got to do something about that right away. That can really degrade the condition of the building in a hurry. You've got to fix that. On the other hand, if what you need to do to get your condition score up is the building isn't air-conditioned and gets too hot in the fall and in the spring on the two ends of the school year, it'd be nice to have more air-conditioned buildings. You could do more things in the summer if you had them. But That's something we should fund at times when we have booms and surpluses, and be able to not fund at times when there's shortages. So is the system that we're devising with this bill flexible enough to accommodate the differences in the state's finances? Because, Mr. Chairman, this state has been boom and bust since the year one, and I don't see it changing. And when the times are good, we can afford to do the condition things that would be nice to have. And when they're not good, we can't afford to do those things. We better stick with fixing the roof and the essential things. Does the system that you're devising here accommodate to that kind of fluctuation, which we will have in our revenues?
Senator Devon Slater first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe to relieve some of the fear and anxiety of the student body at Willow Creek School, if you go down a little further into this same chapter on 2115-119, it does talk about the budget, and the budget of this commission will be presented, and inevitably it'll end up in front of us. And so we really truly get the vote on should they want to close the school, and then the shift of what they would do with those students. And it does say amounts appropriated by the legislature shall not be construed to be an entitlement or guaranteed amount and shall be expended by the commission in accordance with facility guidelines to ensure adequate, efficient, and cost-effective school buildings and facilities. So in other words, if they were going to close that and make some big adjustment and it asked for any kind of capital outlay, which I assume that would, it would end up in front of us and we would vote on it up or down and have the argument that, no, the debate that we've had over the years.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as some of the things that I recall from the facilities meetings that, you know, it wasn't intended or it's not really worded to looking at building the, you know, Taj Mahals these exceptionally high schools. And what we're looking at doing here and getting in the criteria is the facilities commission or the group there wanted the commission to look at different standards for, and we kind of wanted to give them some guidelines on some areas to look at that were noted to be critical for student achievements, you know, like adequate lighting, for example, you know, doesn't meet standards, you know, and looking at and scoring and not ever saying that some of these aren't going to be designed at we're not going to be building new schools because of some of these, but there are going to be some possibly, you know, in the scoring system and the possibilities of doing some maintenance around those areas, and certainly not, you know, demolishing a school because of these standards, but just making sure that, you know, we have adequate standards for our kids and not, you know, looking at building these, you know, as some of their concerns were, tearing down or building a building because of that.
Senator Hicks, sorry.
I would like to support my honorable colleague from Natorna County with his previous discussion related to illumination, but what strikes fear in my heart is when we put criteria in here, we say up-to-date standards for air quality. Whose standards? State of Wyoming standards? Environmental Protection Agency standards? I'd sure like to know whose standards that we're going to hold these school facilities to. It presents to me a moving target. We could have a brand new facility, the rules change by the Environmental Protection Agency, and we've just created a $30 million facility that we're going to go back into. So until I see definitive language along the line of what constitutes air quality and whose criteria we're using, it gives me a great deal of concern.
Further discussion? Senator Jennings on this easy little bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. let's go back to the leaky roof, Mr. Chairman. The leaky roof scenario falls under maintenance and major maintenance and all that kind of stuff. The criteria of the building is different. What we're really dealing here with this bill is one small piece of a great big process and formula that's used by facilities to grade the buildings. And we got into that quite a bit. I mean, they gave us their book, and I would encourage all of you to take a look at it if you're interested in how we're grading these buildings. This is over the years, this is a very complex formula. What we're doing here is we're taking the capacity issue, we're pulling it down a little bit, and we're pushing the condition of the building up a little bit. And as we've talked before, that's what, because of the growth in the different areas and it's stabilizing, we think that's probably a justifiable thing. One of the other things that we heard in the facilities over this last year talking about is when you have a building, you also have the original design. So you have to go back to that original design on a lot of pieces and look at it and say, is this building functioning under that design? And when we go in and our new senator just brought up a really good point here. I can't remember that we did have a discussion on whose standards. I know there's a lot of building standards out there as codes and whatnot that says if you're going to have to move X number of cubic feet of air through an airspace like that. I believe that's the standard, but I'll go back and check on that one. We most certainly, my friend from Natrona County, we did not talk about green power whatsoever under these. I thoroughly believe coal makes the best electricity. So I think that's it. If there's any other questions, I think we've tried to cover most of them. Again, this is a tweak in a big formula. This is a tweak in a big formula just to move one component up because of the way that our population has changed. And I'd hope you'd have a favorable vote on it.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just to remind folks, this is a select committee that's worked on these. All these issues are complicated. Every issue that we've discussed comes up every year when the appropriation process comes through. And I'm certain, without having said on the select committee, the same discussions goes throughout the process of first evaluating it by the Facilities Commission and then the select committee, which is a permanent select committee, to evaluate those recommendations. But in essence, we're not talking about how much money you're going to spend. That's an appropriation process. You're talking about the priority. Where do you sit on the list as opposed to your other schools? Now, I think that the first statement was probably well stated. We have generally good schools throughout the state. But it is prudent for us to continue to repair and replace buildings at a pace that we can afford so we don't get a backlog of buildings and all of a sudden have to run out and replace a bunch of schools when we don't have the resources to do it. So it's priorities. If you take the issue of air quality, we're not talking about air conditioning. Now, if you do build a building, your cost of construction, your fixed costs are the cheapest cost you'll ever pay. The cost of maintaining it after that is far more expensive over 30 years than the cost of constructing. So that's when you talk about, do you put an air conditioning unit in? Do you make sure that if 20 years for 5 years or 20 years we want to go to year-round schools that we can have facilities to enable that? Air quality, if it can be repaired by an HVAC system, the next section says you do that. You don't get a new school. If, on the other hand, you don't have an HVAC system or you have a return air system that's going through a bunch of mold and it can't be repaired, that might throw you to the top of the list. But no matter what happens, we have committees to evaluate it, and all we're simply doing is saying, in the past, capacity has been the driver. And now we're going to shift a little bit and make, say, capacity has less to do with it, because that should not be the driver. We have some schools that really ought to be higher on the list, and there are other ways to address capacity other than building brand new schools. So we have committees that review this. They prioritize it, and no matter what happens, you've got to have prioritizations. Finally, remember that the commission has rulemaking authority. So to the extent that these things are, there are issues with respect to, they need definition, the commission then promulgates rules to help guide them on how to interpret and implement our legislation. We get an opportunity to review those rules, and if we don't like the rules, we can come in, we can either ask that the governor not sign the rules into place, or we can come back and change the law to make sure those rules don't get implemented.
Further discussion on Senate File 16. Question being called for. The motions on the questions on Senator Jennings' motion that Senate File 16 pass committee of the whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 16 pass committee of the whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee of the whole beg leave to rise and sit again.
All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. That motion has been adopted.
I guess I'm afraid of. Beg to rise and leave.
Are there any announcements before we... Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk after... Are there any announcements?
Senator Geis.
Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources will meet up on adjournment about 14.
You'll have to stand closer to your mic. I think it is turned on.
We got it tuned up now?
It's on.
Mr. President, your Committee Agriculture, State Land, Public, State and Public Lands and Water Resources will meet upon adjournment tonight to handle Senate File 5, State Lands Improvement, Senate File 6, Animal Damage Management Board Reports, Senate File 7, State Fair, and Senate File 46, Stock Water Permits.
Hey, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, would you like to make the motion? Thank you.
Mr. President, Joint Rules Committee will meet this afternoon upon adjournment in rooms B67 in the basement to consider joint rules. Unless there's further announcements, Mr. President, I would move that the Senate be in recess until 2 p.m.
Are there further announcements? Senator Hines.
Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet at 12:30 p.m. today in room S16 and take up Senate File 21, Property Tax Exemption for Nonprofit Museums, and Senate File 40, Remote Electronic Terminal Fees.
Other announcements? Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 2, Joint Appropriations, actually it's not committee number 2, it's the Joint Appropriations Committee. I apologize. The Joint Appropriations Committee began a hearing from the governor this morning. We'll take up action again at 12:30 to continue hearing from the governor. We're not completed with the governor, we'll finish up with the governor after. That's kind of interesting, finish up with the governor. I kind of like that. But we'll complete our task of discussing the budget changes with the governor after adjournment and probably immediately after the Rules Committee meets. When we're done with that, we'll move on to hearings with the Department of Health. And at present, if we get through all that work, on Friday, tomorrow at 8 a.m., we'll take up the Game and Fish Department, Department of Environmental Quality, and at, during the lunch break, the Department of Agriculture and the Livestock Board. And if we don't finish up with the Department of Health, we may have to take them in the afternoon. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further announcements? You've heard the motion that the Senate stand recessed until 2 p.m. We are at recess.